information UCork had generated, both of which were hidden in the folds of the morning's newspaper. By now it was past Thanksgiving, and winter, like an infection, was beginning to breed in the wind. As Stan casually picked up the paper, he told me the little about Evan Miller he'd learned. In confidence, Jim had let loose this lone detail about the Olympics in order to reassure Stan. Sennett's motives for telling me, again as a supposed secret, were more pointed. "Make sure your guy knows she's tougher than she looks," he said. "Don't let him think he can roll over her or outfox her. He plays games, we'll know." A smile tempted me, as it often did confronting Stan's prosecutorial macho, but that riled him. I was jogging in place to keep warm, and Stan stood up from the bench and showed me the newspaper where the signed documents were concealed. "I have all my cookies on the line here, George. Every IOU and Benny. There's nothing left in the favor bank. Don't let him mess with me. And not just for my sake, for his. He screws around, and the way DC wrote the guidelines, we'll have to roll it up and land on him with both feet. Make sure he understands." I assured him Robbie recognized that if Stan caught him lying, he was certain to end up in prison. But Stan laid a finger on my chest for emphasis. "I'm telling you this as a friend," he said, and repeated himself once more before he took off again down the path in the lifting darkness. "We'll know." As I said, this is a lawyer's story. I mean that not only because it is an account of the law's fateful impact, but also in the sense that I tell it, as attorneys often do, for those who cannot speak for themselves. I witnessed many of the events of Project Petros firsthand, inasmuch as Robbie always insisted, as he had from the moment Sennett appeared on his doorstep, that I be present whenever Stan was. My memories are enhanced by the hundreds of hours of conversations I have had over the years with the participants, and also by the kind of historical detritus the law often leaves behind. Tapes and transcripts and volumes of FBI case reports, called 302s. Yet, left at that, the tale would be incomplete. The law's truth never ends strictly with the evidence. It depends as well on what attorneys call inference, and what less restricted souls refer to as imagination. Much of Robbie's day-to-day activity was observed only by the agent codenamed Evan Miller, and for the sake of a full account, I have freely imagined her perspectives. Whether she would agree with everything I attribute to her, I cannot say. She has told me what she may, but much of her version is forever locked away behind FBI regulations. My surmises, my conjecture and inference, my imagining would never pass muster in a courtroom, but I regard them as the only avenue to the whole truth that the law and a story always demand. As for my own role, I hope not to appear like those old warriors whose glory only seems to grow over the years. There was nothing heroic about my part in Petros. The uncomfortable truth is that as soon as I heard what Stan Sennett had in mind that first day in his office, I wanted no part of representing Robbie Favor. As a lawyer, I lived by a solemn watchword: never offend a judge. I laughed at all their jokes. When they ruled against me, even stupidly, I said thank you. I solemnly refrained from any discussion about the ability or temperament of anyone on the bench, living or dead. I have rarely seen a judge who did not bear grudges. It is one of the perks of unquestioned power. And I knew the grudges formed against the person who represented Robbie Favor would last. Not because all our judges were corrupt. On the contrary, most of them felt, with good reason, that they'd been lifting their skirts high for years to avoid the muddy playing fields of Kendall County. Now they'd be soiled nonetheless. The newspapers would print editorial cartoons representing the courthouse as a cash register. Drunks at ball games and bars would make crude jokes whenever a judge took a $20 bill out of his pocket. Having traded the bounty of private practice for the esteem of the bench, they would feel swindled in life's bazaar. And the first person they'd pick on was me, who, unlike Stan or Robbie, would be seen as having chosen to participate for the grubby motive of a fee. So, as I wandered down Marshall Avenue, returning that mid-September day from Stan's office, I was trying to figure how I could get out of the case. I could ask for a staggering retainer, or claim that I'd been suddenly called for a trial that would consume all my time, but I knew I wasn't going through with any of it. In the simplest terms, I couldn't stand to draw so dismal a contrast between myself and Sennett, who'd just given me his valorous speech about his Uncle Petros. I never fully understood my lifelong contest with Stan, but I always felt I was running behind. Part of it was that I'd chosen the lucre of private practice, while he lived the more chaste life of a public servant. Part was because as a defense lawyer, I circumvented and thwarted and apologized, while he, as a prosecutor, smote hard blows for what he believed was good and just. Yet now, in the wake of my father's death, I realized there was a way in which I'd always compared myself to Stan in fear. At the age of 22, with my degree from Charlottesville, I'd become a hand on an ore freighter, which had brought me in time to Kendall County. Ostensibly, I'd joined the Merchant Marine to avoid Vietnam, but I was really fleeing my parents' hermetic world in Southern Virginia, escaping from my mother's relentless social pretensions, and even more from my father's call to the inviolable credos of a Southern gentleman. A lawyer before me, my father adhered to what he regarded as the right things: Christ and country, family, duty, and the law. He found, late in life, as he watched less able and principled colleagues promoted to the spots on the bench which he craved, that his unwavering virtue marked him in many eyes, probably including his son's, as a bit of a fool. In the raw democracy of Kendall County, where honor was not a matter of social attainment, I'd felt free to live a life of reasonable adult accommodations. But with my father gone, I suddenly feared I'd cast away too many things he had exalted. I was a decent man, but seldom brave. That was why Sennett, for the moment, seemed so formidable. Like my father, he was a person of rigor, of standards, a purist who believed powerfully and uncompromisingly in the wide gulf between evil and good. As a boy, Stan had briefly been a seminarian preparing to enter the priesthood of the Greek Orthodox Church, and I always sensed that in his mind, as in my dad's, law and God were not far apart. Yet unlike my father, Stan had the fiber to recognize that in this world good things do not happen by accident. I realize now that a piece of me had always seen Stan as the man I might have been were I more determined to be a loyal son. So I knew I'd have no peace with myself if I turned away from Robbie Favor. I remembered the lines from Frost about the road not taken, and then, like the poet, turned to follow Robbie and Sennett down that unfamiliar path. January 1993. Chapter 5. The Le Sueur building, where Robbie and I both made our law offices, had been erected just before the economic collapse of the 1920s. It stands on a part of Center City called The Point, a jut of Midwestern limestone that the River Kendall, in its swift course, somehow chose over the eons to avoid rather than wear through. The building commemorates the French missionary explorer Père Guy Le Sueur, whose family name was perpetually misspelled by the unlettered settlers who followed him 2 centuries later to this part of the Middle West. The Le Sueur was built in the era of Deco. Waif-like naiads modestly shield their nakedness behind the leafy adornments embossed at the center of the elaborate brass grills that decorate the elevators, the air vents, and much of the lobby. A cupola of stained glass, the design of Louis Tiffany himself, rises over the seven-story center atrium and lures frequent tour groups who often obstruct the tenants racing to work. For the most part, it is law, not art, which preoccupies the denizens. More than half the space in the building has always been leased by attorneys, inasmuch as the Lesueur stands at a favored location, the center of a triangle formed by Federal Square at one point, the state criminal courts on the second, and on the third, the architectural recycling bin that is the Kendall County Superior Court Law and Equity Department. Late in November, a lawyer named James McManus leased a vacant suite in the lower rent region of the Lesueur's eighth floor. McManus, who appeared to be near 50, was making a late start in private practice. For many years, he explained to various lawyers in the building, to whom he eagerly introduced himself, he had been an associate general counsel for Moreland Insurance, situated in their South Central regional office in Atlanta, in charge of personal injury claims. McManus told a complicated story about leaving Moreland so his wife could tend to her elderly mother in Greenwood County, and said his move had been supported by Moreland's general counsel, who had agreed to jumpstart McManus's practice by hiring him to conduct the defense of various personal injury claims brought in Kendall County against Moreland's insureds. Listening to McManus's tale, one could not avoid the impression that it had been sanitized a bit, and that McManus was actually one more middle-aged expendable cut adrift in another of the ruthless corporate downsizings familiar to recession America. Jim McManus quickly assembled a staff. Every few days there was a new employee, a secretary, an investigator, a receptionist, a law clerk, a paralegal, each of whom was offhandedly introduced to the adjoining tenants. All, of course, were FBI agents hailing from locales far from Kendall County. Given the fact that not long into January the law offices of James McManus had four separate matters against Favor and Dinnerstein, it was not unusual that Robbie and his paralegal, even Miller, made occasional visits downstairs. So did I. My cover, employed with the greatest reluctance, was that I was the referring attorney on these cases, the lawyer who'd put the plaintiffs in touch with Favor, and who would be entitled to a piece of Robbie's fee in exchange for working with him on the lawsuits. McManus had also joined the Kendall County Bar Association's Task Force on Civility in the Courts, chaired by Stan Sennett. Thus Sennett, too, became a frequent visitor to McManus's. Each of us came to Jim's office, referred to by the agents within as the off-site, at least once a week, far more often in the early days. We approached at prearranged intervals, always equipped with a briefcase or an envelope as a prop. Arriving in the reception area, richly paneled in red oak, I felt as if I were watching TV from inside the set. Everyone was playing a role, but until the steel-lined doors to the conference room were secured, all maintained a convincing atmosphere of earnest busyness, phones bleeding, printers groaning, the various employees dashing back and forth. What each of them was actually up to was not shared with me, but in one of the early meetings a door was left ajar on a wall-length cabinet in the conference room, where I noticed a full bank of electrical equipment, stuff with blinking lights and digital readouts. As for the so-called Even Miller, she was the first to respond to an ad for a paralegal Favor and Dinnerstein placed in the Lawyer's Bulletin in early January. She was interviewed the next day by Mort, Robbie, and the office manager Eileen Rubin. For the interview she wore a trim blue suit, a ruffled white blouse, and a doubled strand of costume pearls she'd probably worn four times since getting them for college graduation. Her glasses were gone now, in favor of contacts, and to give her the jazzier look Sennett preferred, She'd also had a makeover at Elizabeth Arden on Michigan Avenue in Chicago at Bureau expense. It included bleaching her hair bright blonde and trimming it into a high-styled do buzzed down to fuzz on one side as it slid toward her ear. On the first day after Evan Miller was hired, Robbie strutted her around the harshly lit corridors of the firm. He explained the layout, introduced other employees with maladroit quips, and unapologetically boasted about the lavish decorations. Gaudy contemporary pieces, resin figures, neon sculptures, huge clocks, were clustered on the silky peach-colored paper covering the walls. The conference room was dominated by the longest table she had ever seen outside a museum, an oval of pinkish granite surrounded by Italian-designed armchairs, its polished surface glazed with the oblique light from the large windows on the Lesueur's 35th floor. Favor referred to the room as the palace.
"See, we lay it on thick for the play," he said. "Know what I mean?" She didn't. "My first legal job, I worked for Peter Newkris. You've heard of Peter, right? Everybody's heard of Peter. The master of disaster, that's what the papers call him. Peter can be understated. We're Favor and Dinnerstein. Who are they?"
"The arrogant docs who come here for their depots, our clients, who are mostly little people from the apartments and bungalows. They all want to know one thing. Are these guys successful? Do they win? So, it's got to show. You drive a Mercedes, you wear Zegna, and your office looks like Robin Leach should be coming through the door any second. I told Mort when we started, think Beverly Hills."
Beverly Hills, Evan thought.
Favor brought to mind the brassy city types she began encountering in town as a child when two ski resorts cropped up like pimples on the clear face of adjacent mountains. Dark, gabby men stuck on themselves. Operators like Favor, with his guy's guy air and a style that made you wonder if, like a slug, he would leave a grease track behind. But she'd been an agent for 10 years now and had dealt with her share of bottom feeders and flippers. As an FOA in Boston, a first office agent, a rookie, she'd worked with dopers, and everybody knew those people were the worst. Her job here, she told herself, was to keep an eye out, to make sure this boy did his stuff, stayed straight as 6 o'clock, and didn't get bushwhacked in the process. Beyond that, she figured, it did not really matter if the bugger had ringworm or an attitude. Roger Wilco over and out. They were in Favor's office now. His secretary, Bonita, a pretty smooth-skinned Latina with torrents of cosmetics-ravaged hair and eyeshadow applied like finger paint, had come in to greet her. Favor continued in the role of new employer, detailing a paralegal's duties. She'd schedule deps, issue subpoenas and interrogatories, handle court filings, even meet with clients to gather info and hold hands.
"And here's another thing," Favor was saying. "You and Bonnie work this out, but I don't read the mail. For 15 years I got holes in my stomach from the mail. Then I turned 40 and said life's too short. Because one thing is surer than gravity, there is only bad news in the mail, no lie. First is always motions, bane of my existence. On the other side of every case we have, there's a defense firm getting paid by the hour. So it's money in their pocket to file every harebrained, damaged, not a chance in hell motion they can think of. Motion to dismiss, motion for summary judgment, motion to reconsider prior motion, motion to declare Puerto Rico a state. You can't believe this. And we're on a contingency. Nobody pays me to answer this dreck. And if I win 10 motions but lose the 11th, the whole case still craters."
Favor went on, describing the disasters he could encounter in his inbox every morning. There were letters from clients who'd been romanced by other attorneys and were discharging them, often after years of work. Urgent alerts from trial lawyers' organizations about anti-plaintiff legislation which the insurance lobby had inspired. And, of course, never the checks that defense lawyers owed on resolved cases.
"Only bad news," he concluded.
Bonita stood near Favor's glass-topped desk, chuckling indulgently, then departed, closing the door at her boss's request. The whirring sounds of the office, the phones and the machines and the urgent voices, were closed off now, and even felt a sudden quickening. She had not been alone with him before. He chucked his chin toward her in a familiar way.
"So, what's your real name?"
he asked quietly. She stood a second without moving.
"Even."
"Oh, come on, I feel like we're at a costume party. You know my name."
"My name is Even Miller, Mr. Favor."
He asked where she was really from, whether she was married. She gave him back her myth without expression.
"Christ," he said.
Favor's office was large, with a leather sofa and a desk and tables in contemporary stylings of glass and wood. The floor was covered by an immense oriental rug, a wine-red Bokhara, at the center of which she was standing. She tightened her jaw and spoke to him in a low, hardened voice. They were not playing charades, she said. She repeated what had been drilled into her. Never give it up. Never. Not for one second. That way you don't worry about being overheard or caught out. "You get used to breaking cover," she said, "and you'll mess up sure as sunrise when the pressure's on." "Oh, don't you worry about me handling a role," he told her. "I'm a pro." He pointed to the credenza behind him where a picture of his wife sat. The photo showed Lorraine as she'd been before disease had plundered her. Within the broad silver frame, Rainy, as she was sometimes called, remained an extraordinary raven-haired beauty, with eyes almost the color of an amethyst, and a lengthy pointed jaw, an irregular element that somehow elevated her looks from the merely cute or pleasant. But it was a photograph beside it he had meant to point out, a glossy close-up of him in grease paint and a pirate's costume, apparently engaged in song. "Bar Show 1990 was engraved on a phony gold plaque below it. "Look, we're going to spend a lot of time together," he said. "I'm just trying to find out a little about you. The way I figure," he said, "they couldn't just uproot you if you didn't want to go. So you don't have kids, right?" She was never adept with people, and somehow he had seen that. He knew she'd have no smooth way to stop him. "No," he said, "no kids. And I figure you're single, too. Single person would be the first one they'd ask. They wouldn't expect somebody married to spend the next year away from home. Divorcee or never took the plunge. That's where I'm stuck."
"That's enough," she said.
"Relax," he answered. He was having a good time, leaning back in the chrome-armed leather reclining chair behind his desk. "I already know about the Olympics." That finally ignited her, finding that even now, undercover, that single damnable detail was being paraded miles before her like a banner on a standard. Just that fast, she was leaning over his desk, ignoring a furtive quiver of his eyes, which she immediately suspected was a brief effort to look down her blouse.
"Listen, mister, the 302s, the reports I read, they said that some of these guys have got real mean friends. Isn't that what you told us? So you better act like your life is at stake, bud, because as far as I can tell, it is."
He shrunk his lips and turned a cheek, his beard so dense that even clean-shaven it seemed to turn his skin blue. The man was furry as a bear. A few renegade chest hairs peeked over his collar.
"What about a wire?" he asked. "George says you may be wired."
I had told him, actually, that the government was unlikely to do that. On hours of tape, there were bound to be 100 idle remarks that could prove embarrassing to both Robbie and Even on cross-examination. And there were complicated issues of attorney-client privilege with an open mic in a law office. Yet there was always the chance, in the brittle bureaucracy of D.C., where the practical often mattered little compared to camouflaging behinds, that UCork might have insisted on taping in order to have unchallenged proof that they had kept Favor in line.
"Are you going to answer me?"
Favor asked as she turned for the door.
"No."
"Which means you're wired," Favor said.
If I were you, brother, I'd assume I was.
I'd told him as much, since Evan was obliged to report any act of dishonesty that might bear on Robbie's future credibility as a government witness.
I knew you were wired.
He was so pleased with himself he actually clapped.
Look, darn it, I'm not wired. Now stick with the cover and button it up. And what would you tell me if you were wired?
She'd had it. Coming around the desk, she grabbed him for a second by the shoulder.
Listen, she said. Ordinarily, I'd say you want to kill yourself, go ahead. But the sharp edge of the sword here is that if your life's on the line, so is mine. Now either you shape up or I'll call this whole thing off and you can go sit in the can where you belong.
Favor took his time. He deliberated on the hand with its bright nails, which she'd removed by now, then turned his long face up to her.
Hey,
he gave her a lopsided grin aimed at appearing good-natured.
We're just fucking with each other.
He had that half right.
We're going to catch plenty of bad guys, he called as she retreated.
She wheeled and pointed. I thought we already caught one.
I call her Evan because that's what she called herself. She once told me that as a teenager she'd undergone a period of religious passion in which her complete devotion to God seemed to remove her from normal life, as if she'd acquired the power to levitate or leave her body behind. And now she felt something akin, a limitless stake in being Evan Miller. She'd burned the details into herself. 34, Mormon family, born in Boise. 3 years of college at Boise State. Married to her high school sweetheart, Dave Ard, a flight mechanic for United with whom she'd moved to Denver. Divorced since 1988. She'd collected 100 particles of an imagined past with which to spice offhand conversations. When she talked to herself, she called herself Evan. She ate the food Evan Miller liked. She window shopped in the stores favored by Evan, whose tastes for shorter skirts, brighter colors, bigger earrings were, blessedly, just a little more daring than hers. And at night, she was certain, she dreamed Evan Miller's dreams. 6 weeks ago, the ASAC, the assistant special agent in charge of the Des Moines division, Hack Bielinger, had called her into his office. It was not really an office, but a cubicle with a door. In his stubby hands, he'd held a teletype on pulpy yellow paper. Bielinger was like a lot of the bureau supervisors she'd had, hard to like, a guy who had moved up because he really wasn't cut out for the street, and who still tended to resent the agents he oversaw who were good on the pavement. He was a small, fussy man. People always speculated that he'd fudged the height requirement, a born-again who didn't get what was wrong with bringing up Jesus at lunch.
"Got something interesting for you," he said.
Reading the teletype, she felt as if somebody had hitched a generator to her heart. The message was from the DD, the office of the FBI's deputy director. "Please advise re-willingness referenced SA to accept assignment in originating UCO. Case City. Division term indeterminate. Estimate 6 months to 2 years. Deep cover." Bielinger wasn't smiling. In fact, he was tense. The DD wanted this, so he had to deliver. That was Bielinger. He said he'd had a call a week ago, kind of unofficial. He told them she'd be good.
"They need somebody who's trained as a paralegal," Bielinger shrugged.
Why was a mystery to him, but it meant he must have asked, "Why her? What's so special about her?" The men in the bureau always had the same reactions. Chicks these days get first lick on every lollipop. The agent who was going to run the op had flown out to meet her. He said to call him Jim, no last name. Everything on this deal was strictly need to know. But she liked him. Smart, sober, quiet. Somewhere on the sunny side of 50.
He was good-looking, despite some chunkiness as he steamed into his middle years, with big glasses and a full head of graying hair that dropped in a boyish sweep over his forehead. He didn't say where he was from, but she figured D.C. He had an HQ finish and knew all the right names. From the bread that his shoulders, the way he filled up his shirts, she could see he'd been a jock at some point in his life. She took that as a bond. He had that contained aura of well-being, an aspect of sporting success she'd observed in so many others, especially men, but which somehow had never settled in her.
"It's hard," he said about what he was proposing. "I was under almost a year once." He described the case. He had worked on Wall Street. He was supposed to be a bad guy who ran the back office operations at a big brokerage house, a quiet, sullen suit who manipulated the box count and fenced stolen securities. It was a big sting. They rolled up three LCN, La Cosa Nostra, Capos. One more nail in the Gambino's coffin. "I'm proud of what we did. And on Friday night, other agents will always treat you like a hero, especially if you're paying for the beer." A droll grin lit up and passed, a momentary indulgence subject to quick discipline. "But it was hard and lonely and dangerous. People's lives depend on whether you get made, and so you're paranoid every minute, every hour. It wears." He repeated that. "It wears." She tried to take that in respectfully. But she told him what she knew she was going to before they started. She was ready. He wanted to know why. 44 caliber adrenal glands, she answered. He'd probably already read that in her personnel jacket. First hand raised to help out on a bust, weekends, evenings, even with the local cops. Still addicted to the instant of unthinking reaction she first experienced on the playing field. "Must be something besides that," the man whom she now knew as McManus had said. "You're going to be putting yourself through a lot." They were in a drab little conference room in the Des Moines division. His quiet way somehow a contrast to the phones and commotion just beyond. His eyes, pale gray, didn't leave her. In the bureau, they were always trying to get inside your head. When she'd taken the qualifying test after college, there was a psychological portion, and one question still reared up at her, at times, out of the murky turbulence of nightmares. "If your mother and father were both drowning, which one would you save?" Someday she'd have to find out the right answer. She shrugged off his scrutiny now. It was tough to name any grand motive. She wanted it. Who knew why? But his response had wrung something inside her. "My bet," he said, "is you'll find out." Chapter 6 In his initial debriefings, Robbie had confirmed what the government had already detected, namely that at any one time there were only a few judges in common law claims with whom he could talk. This seemed peculiar to Senate, since Toohey had veto power over all assignments to his division. Robbie regarded it as characteristic of Brendan, who had an exquisite instinct for being exposed. Toohey wanted common law claims to be known for its cadre of highly capable and unhesitatingly honest judges. Their reputations would armor him with an aura of integrity, while the few exceptions could be passed off as the typical party debris inevitable with an elected judiciary. Of the dozen judges to whom favor had passed money over the years, most were gone now, retired or transferred to other divisions. If Petros ran perfectly, Robbie would try to secure evidence against them as part of the endgame. But to start, the focus would be on the four judges currently sitting in common law claims, with whom favor was still doing business. With them, there would be a chance to stage bribes, which, when recorded, would provide the government with the best opportunity to leverage those judges against Toohey. When the names of the four judges emerged from Robbie, I'd been shocked about two, because I knew both men. Sherm Crowthers had been one of the best defense lawyers in this city when I entered practice, a ferocious, angry advocate who, if not always liked, was deeply admired both for his abilities and for the obstacles he'd surmounted as a black man. Hearing Sherm's name had sunk my heart. Silvio Malatesta, the other judge I knew on Robbie's list, inspired simple disbelief. Malatesta was a donnish, bespectacled Magoo who never seemed to leave the universe of his own head, through which various elevated legal notions were always tracing like shooting stars. It was amazing to me that he even experienced the material appetites that led to corruption. As for the other two names, I probably would have guessed them on my own if I ever had the gumption to speak such slanders aloud. Gillian Sullivan was a lush who'd been coming on the bench loaded in the afternoons for at least a decade, and about whom we'd received constant complaints during my term as bar president. Wandering through her alcoholic wilderness, Sullivan probably thought little about right or wrong. Barnett Skolnick, the last, was the brother of the late Knuckles Skolnick, a former intimate of the departed county executive Augustine Bolcaro. Barney was the kind of old-time party flunky who, in my mind, was typecast for envelopes of cash. The threshold problem Stan faced in mounting these prosecutions was that, except in the case of Skolnick, who might be tempted to take money from Robbie directly, all the others dealt strictly through intermediaries, a clerk, a relative, a paramour. In the ideal, Senate would tape several payoffs to these bagmen, confront them, make a deal, and get them to record the delivery of money to the judges. But these go-betweens had each been chosen because they demonstrated the loyalty of Gunga Din, and it was far from a sure thing that any of them could be turned. If not, Petros might yield nothing but the convictions of a number of small-timers. To counter this, Senate initially hoped to design the contrived cases, these imaginary plaintiffs' lawsuits, so that the judges would be called upon to make a series of far-fetched rulings in Robbie's behalf. That way, even if the bagman didn't roll, Stan could still go forward against the judge by calling a bevy of expert witnesses to testify that no honest jurist could possibly have made these decisions. But Favor adamantly insisted that approach would never succeed.
"You guys still don't get the play," Favor told Senate. "We got judges making 90 grand and lawyers making millions. Figure how you like. Say it's a tip, or tribute, or insurance for next time. But I got cases I ought to win, and I want to make sure the judge doesn't get confused. Maybe I get a little help when things can go either way. But if I walk in with some mangy dog and ask the judge to act like it's Lassie, which in 10 years I swear to God in heaven I have never done, if I do, the best I get is that the judge won't talk to me again. Worst case, Brendan gets hinky and sends somebody to knife me, and the only thing left to do in the law offices of James McManus is run the vacuum and kill the lights. This may be a little mind-blowing to you guys, but everybody over there realizes you're out here. They do something ridiculous. They know damn well that one of you..." The word "assholes" was halfway to Robbie's lips when he managed to stifle it. He took a second to improve his posture and pulled on his shirt cuffs so that an inch of white emerged over his dangling ID bracelet. "The Judicial Commission, or the Bar Association, or you guys, one of you, is going to be humping them from behind." Thus each complaint, a summary of the facts the plaintiff said entitled him to damages for his injury, had to be constructed so it fell in that borderland where victory for Robbie was reasonable but not required. In the first suit filed, Robbie's firm supposedly represented Peter Petros. Peter had indisputably become drunk as a lord at a hands basketball game. In the course of an obscene tirade at the referees, he had fallen over the balcony railing. His survival was accountable only to his state of inebriate relaxation and the fact that he had hit the canopy of a hot dog cart before bouncing to the concrete stadium floor. Petros sued the fictitious railing manufacturer, Standard Railing,
claiming that because of the inherent danger of balcony seating, Standard was automatically liable for not building a product that prevented Peter's injuries. In behalf of Standard, the law offices of James McManus immediately filed a motion to dismiss, contending that even if everything Peter said was true, under the law, he had no case. The legal arguments had been designed so that the decision on the motion was a toss-up. On January 12th, Even went with the other paralegal, Susie Krasick, and filed the complaint at the Kendall County Courthouse, a normal procedure. It was the next step, getting the case to what Robbie referred to as a good judge, which represented the first deviation. To do that, Robbie left a phone message at the office of Sig Milaki. Milaki, Brendan's old partner from the police force, was now assigned as the police liaison to the sheriff's deputies who acted as courthouse security. Robbie simply asked for a case number on a new matter, Petros v. Standard Railing. What happened then had never been spelled out to Favor, and he had no reason to ask. Over the years, though, it had become apparent that Milaki passed the message to Rollo Kosick, chief bailiff to the presiding judge, who somehow overrode the court's computerized system for random case assignments. When Even returned to the courthouse on Monday to pick up a file copy of the Petros complaint, Judge Silvio Malatesta, one of Robbie's unholy foursome, had been assigned. We met again in McManus's office, where the government personnel began preparing to ensnare Malatesta, and, before him, his bagman, an ill-tempered docket clerk named Walter Wunsch. According to the well-ingrained custom that ruled these matters with the firmness of religious practice, Robbie would not deliver a payoff to Walter until the end of the case. But both Stan and McManus wanted to get a recording earlier. McManus thought Robbie should have experience wearing a wire in a less pressured situation than passing money. Stan was eager to develop live evidence since UCork had him on a standing 30-day review, which meant they could fold the entire project whenever they were unsatisfied with its progress. Robbie agreed that in the ordinary course he might pay a visit to Walter when he filed his response to McManus's motion to dismiss, just to make sure that Malatesta recognized the merits of plaintiff's position. With that, arrangements began for Robbie to go out wired for the first time as soon as the motion and response were filed, in about 2 weeks. After the meeting, Robbie and I went up to my office. I left to speak to my secretary for a moment, and when I returned, I found Robbie in a reflective pose in front of the large old windows, taking in my view of the Center City skyline. The new steel-shelled structures, sleek as airliners, mingled with the buildings of the 20s, which were usually topped off by some impression of bygone architectural styles, Gothic spires, Italianate cupolas, or even one that had a glimmering helmet of cerulean tile, an allusion to a Middle Eastern mosque. To the west, the river's waters were smoke-colored and mysterious under the wintry Midwestern sky. The bleak season had started. These days it seemed like living under a pot lid. I asked Robbie if the arrangements for the recording had sounded okay.
"I suppose," he answered. I thought it was the fear of detection that had made him subdued, but as it turned out, his concern was elsewhere. "I'm going over the bridge," he told me when he looked back my way. Up until now, I had largely seen all of this in my own terms. My job was to keep Robbie out of prison, and I was delighted with my apparent success. Despite that, Robbie faced many losses. His practice, and the money that came with it, not to mention his reputation. But now he was going to make his first real break with everything he had. If all went well with the wire, he would betray Walter Wunsch in a fashion that every friend and acquaintance would deem unpardonable. The community he'd always belonged to would be left behind. The man who had said on the first day he came to see me that he was not a rat had undoubtedly stood at the window staring not so much at the city but at what he saw of himself. Under the protocol for Petra specified by UCORC, Even had to accompany Favor to every professional engagement, depositions, meetings, court calls, even his wooing of prospective clients, in order to keep an eye on him. Robbie's day often started early, with courtroom appearances in distant counties. Therefore, after Even's initial few days, the scenario called for Favor to pick her up each morning. Coming into the office together would also help foster the impression of a romance. An FBI deep cover team had settled her in South River in a former auto parts warehouse the size of a fortress. Her building, like many in South River, had been recently refurbished into an intriguing warren of condos and apartments with few common corridors. The deep cover team had chosen the apartment building because it was the biggest along Favor's route to and from the office. Large was better, more anonymous. Living undercover, she was supposed to avoid making new acquaintances, since even the friendliest inquiries might trip you up. From the time Favor dropped Even off after 6 p.m. until the sleek white Mercedes appeared at the curb the next morning, she often felt as if she were dwelling in an isolation booth. But there was rarely silence during the long stretches they spent in the car each day. When Favor was not on the phone, which he could dial from a little panel above the temperature controls, he lectured her on any subject that crept into his head. By now she was in mind of a phrase of her father's. The man ran over at the mouth like he'd busted a pipe. Did he ever keep a thought to himself? Ostensibly, he was familiarizing her with the details of his practice, but he clearly felt he was entertaining. He was also quick to recognize that the car was the one place he could comfortably break cover. There had been no further problems in the office, but in the Mercedes, Favor was like a grade school bad boy who needed recess so he could behave himself in class. He was forever trying to pry details about her identity or offering commentary about their meetings with Senate and McManus. She'd face the window and watch the Tri-Cities whiz past, or close her eyes to savor the armchair luxury of the passenger seat. The silver plate on the trunk lid identified the car as an S-600. Top of the line, Favor told her several times. The creamy leather, with its pinpoint air holes, had the feel of the calfskin shoes she could never afford, and the dark walnut of the front cabin reminded her of a museum. Yet it was the quiet that impressed her most. In this thing, outside was really outside. The heavy door thudded shut with a cushioned sound reminiscent of a jewel box. Favor was enraptured with his Mercedes, which he had purchased only a few months before. He often spouted the staggering price, $133,000, unabashed that the car had cost more than some of the four-bedroom houses they passed in outlying developments. Secure within the elegant cabin and its fortress feel, Robbie was apt to become a random element. He zoomed around as if he were in a spaceship. On the way back from the Greenwood County Courthouse, he would pop in on his mother, who was at a nursing home along the way, or visit Sparky, a scalper who was holding tickets for a hands game which Robbie was sending to a referring attorney. Favor also loved to shop. He was a devotee of sales and fancy name brands and frequently made impulsive stops at the malls. Under the bright store lights, he'd scrutinize the merchandise, then call his wife from the car to describe what he was bringing home as if he were a big game hunter. In every venue, Favor entered with a sense of membership. He was known. There were friends of decades and tireless stories. For Robbie, all the world was in some measure a fraternity, a place for upbeat banter, tasteless jokes, and booming laughter. Arriving for a dep where he hoped to eviscerate the opposing party, he nonetheless greeted the other lawyer with cheerful enthusiasm. At the Tony Haberdasher, where he acquired his expensive wardrobe, Robbie had his own salesman, Carlos, a Cuban refugee who welcomed him with the palms-up grip of a brother.
The store was full of men like Robbie, with careful haircuts and a showboat air, guys who considered the fit of their garments in the mirror with an exacting look at odds with the carefree swagger with which they strolled down the avenue. One day, in the third week of January, apropos of nothing, Favor cried out that they had to go see Harold, who turned out to be a client disastrously injured in a collision with a delivery truck. Even could barely stand to look at the man. He was hunched to one side in a wheelchair. There were sores on his arms and face. Robbie, however, took Harold's hand and with barroom gusto told him he looked great. Favor chatted away for nearly 20 minutes about highlights of the basketball season in the mid-10. Afterwards, in the car, he told her he was determined to keep Harold alive. The defendants, the auto manufacturer, the state highway department, the trucking company, had dragged the case out nearly 9 years in the clear hope Harold would die. If he did, a case presently worth $20 million with comps, compensatory damages for lifetime care, might bring 1/5 of that, most of which would go to repay his medical insurer. There would be zilch for Harold's mother, a large-bellied, middle-aged woman in a shapeless dress who had greeted them and who had cared for her son since his wife deserted him shortly after the accident. "What about your fee?" Evan asked dryly. "That goes way down, too, doesn't it?"
"Hey," Favor answered. "You ever meet Peter Newcrest? He'll tell you before he says hello about all the good he's doing for the world, sticking up for everybody who gets abused. Not me. The rules of this game are that we give people money to make up for their pain, and everybody who steps on the field knows how we're going to keep score. The judges, the jury, me, the client, the folks on the other side. It's money. How much do we get? How much do they keep? Whatever people say, let me give you a fast translation. You can dress it up and make it say mommy, but this baby's really talking do-re-mi."
He nodded firmly.
"That's the play."
As always, his smugness was exasperating. Of all the people to think he'd figured everything out.
"What is the play, anyway?" she asked suddenly. "It's always the excuse, and I never get it. Are you saying, like, I made the play in sports? Or I have a part in a play? Or I played a trick on you?"
"Right," he said.
"Come on."
He waved a hand past his nose at the difficulty she was inviting. They were in the suburbs, a land of recently built houses with peaked roofs and few exterior graces. From the highway, she saw two little boys across the distance smacking at a tether ball in the cold.
"Well, shit," said Favor,
unable, as always, to endure his own silence.
"It's just the play. It's like life, you know? There's really no point except getting your jollies, and even that doesn't add up to anything in the end. You think any of this makes sense when you stand back from it? You think God made an ordered universe?"
"That's the laugh with the law.
We like to pretend it makes life more reasonable."
"Hardly," she groaned, which made him more insistent.
"Tell me what sense there is that Lorraine is sick like she is. Any? Why her? Why now? Why that terrible motherfucker of a disease? It doesn't add. Or take a look at our cases. 48-year-old lathe operator, machine goes down and he turns the power off on the line to fix it. The foreman comes back, figures some joker is fucking with him like they do twice a day, and throws the switch. Hand is cut in half.
Off-duty fireman's at somebody's house washing the storm windows.
He's gone for 2 minutes to get more Windex, and the 3-year-old climbs up on a stool to look outside and goes right through the open window, DOA at Mount Sinai. Or Harold, for Christ's sake. 1 minute you're a cheerful salesman on the highway, the next minute you're a meatball in a wheelchair. It's the play. Ball hits a stone on the infield, hops over your glove, and you lose the World Series. You go home and cry. It's really chaos and darkness out there. And when we pretend it's not, it's just the play. We're all on stage, saying our lines.
playing at whoever we're trying to be at the moment. A lawyer, a spouse. Even though we know in the back of our heads that life is a lot more random and messed up than we can stand to say to ourselves. Okay?
His black eyes lit on her despite the highway traffic. Something, his intensity, was frightening.
Okay?
He asked again.
No,
she said.
Why not?
She crossed her arms, deliberating on whether he deserved an answer.
I believe in God, she told him. Me too, he said. But he made me, and this is what I think.
An exasperated sound gargled up from her involuntarily. Didn't she know? Who told her to try to argue with a lawyer? One of those mornings in January, Favor and Even were in the 600, only a few blocks from work, when they became snarled in a honking line of stalled traffic. Far ahead, heavy plumes of what appeared at first to be smoke expanded in the frigid air, swirling above the yellow blinkers atop a cordon of striped barricades and emergency vehicles. Approaching by inches, they eventually saw a covey of city sewer workers in quilted vests and construction helmets leaning on the yellow rail they'd erected around an open manhole. They were engaged in no visible labor other than shouting down to a couple of their colleagues who had descended. A young woman in a hard hat waved a red flag, sending the traffic along through a single lane. When she stopped them abreast of her, Favor lowered his window, admitting a sudden riffle of cold.
"How come the cutest girl's always holding the flag?"
he asked her. She was African-American, with a broad face and wide eyes and lovely peaked cheekbones that plumped with an enormous grin while she flagged him on.
"How do you know her?"
Even asked as the Mercedes spurted ahead in the traffic. He looked puzzled.
"I don't."
"And you just say that to her?"
"Sure. Why not?"
"Because she might mind."
"Did it look like she minded?"
"But what's the point? Can I ask, what's the point of saying that?" Her tone was careful, hoping not to be incendiary. But she'd always wanted to ask his kind of man this question.
"She's cute," he answered. "You think it's easy to look cute in a construction helmet? I don't. You think it's an accident she looks cute? I mean, she got up in the morning, she tied that bandana on her head, even though she'd be wearing a hard hat. She looked at her tush in her jeans. Who was she doing that for?"
On the morning ride, he drove in without a top coat, and he laid the long hand with which he'd been gesturing on his bright tie.
"For me. A million guys like me. And so I say thanks. That's all. That's all. Maybe I'll come through her intersection again someday. Maybe the light turns red. Maybe she's just getting off for lunch. I mean, I can imagine anything. But right now, it's thanks, that's all."
That was Favor. It wasn't a mouth breather. Not the kind of jerk always hopping along on his erection as if it were a pogo stick. He had some style. But he was still on alert, a heat-seeking missile shot through the sky and waiting to lock on. He stood too close when he was speaking. His wife lay at home, dying by the inch each day, and he did not wear a wedding ring. Falling into his car each morning, Even almost gasped at the sickly mix of sweet smells from his eau de cologne, hairspray, fancy shaving cream, and body lotion. He was his own most deeply prized possession, and he liked to advertise this, as if the sheer power of his vanity might overcome a woman. When she'd met McManus the first time in Des Moines, he'd warned her. "RCI." Confidential informant, he meant, a polite term for snitch. "Apparently has a big rep as a ladies' man. You're going to have to act the part, and he's the type who might want to blend fact and fiction." Jim had given her three rules.
First, don't put up with anything that bothered her. They'd back her completely. Second, don't be offended, because she wasn't going to change him. And third, McManus had said, hesitating long enough that she knew this was the important one, don't fall for it. No chance of that, she'd answered. So far, there hadn't been many problems. One time in his office, she'd gotten a sly, sidewise look as he asked, almost offhandedly, when it was Bonita was supposed to stumble upon them going at it on his leather sofa, a portion of the scenario that Evan was still hoping to skip. She'd stiff-armed him with a quick look and had heard no more about it. But there wasn't a woman in the office who wouldn't have warned her. The female employees gathered for coffee breaks and lunches in a narrow interior area that was referred to as the kitchen, a place where a male never visited for a period longer than half a minute to retrieve coffee or the brown sack containing his lunch. Setting her cover, Evan had casually mentioned how kind Robbie had been, stopping for her each morning. Oretta, one of the file clerks, had hooted.
"Girl," she said, "you get in his taxi, sooner or later he'll be asking for the fare."
Shrill, lascivious laughter from each woman reverberated off the steel cabinets. But later, as Bonita was filing, she made it a point to catch Evan in the corridor.
"You know, when I started in here, I was single. You know, we parted some."
She did not use a name, but glanced over her shoulder and tipped the teased-up tufts of jet hair toward Robbie's office. Bonita would not have gotten through the interview without catching Robbie's attention. She wore all her clothing a half-size too tight, her pleasing contours well displayed.
"But pretty soon I went back in to see Hector. And you know, you've got a relationship or something. He'll flirt a little, but he won't push or nothing. If you really mean it. He wants you to like him. That's how he is. Like a little kid."
Bonita slammed the long white file cabinet back into its recess in the wall.
"And you'll like him," she said.
Within the wreck